Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Lynn Arduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me as ever. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How are you doing?
Good. I try to make as ever sound a lot more enthusiastic.
I do worry about as ever. Time. As ever. Lucy's here.
Really put some energy into it.
Like
this
a
time.
Bad penny.
Tell me, have you been enjoying a little freedom to roam now that restrictions have been eased a degree or two?
I don't know about freedom to roam. It does feel a little bit different, doesn't it? It feels nicer. My roaming is more or less in the same places, but it's nice to see that things are beginning to tentatively open up. People are beginning to talk about when theatre and music and things like that might start. That all feels good, doesn't it?
Exactly. And the bookshops are open. I went into a bookshop for the first time in, well, an eternity, and it felt so strange. It felt like more like a museum or an art gallery. Everyone was sort of gazing and in wonder and not touching and moving slowly and speaking in hushed tones.
Well, there's one, our local one, you could order it online and then you could go and pick it up through and pay for it through the window. And so, and it was like getting a takeaway, but you could get takeaway books. So that was brilliant. And so we didn't feel too afflicted by that because you know, you could see what was in the window. And as I say, you could pay for it through the window. So we were very lucky with that.
Is that what do you have to tell me what you purchased now, I'm afraid?
Oh, I can't remember. Loads of things. I certainly bought some books about birds, as did absolutely everybody else. And lots of other stuff. Can't remember.
I went in looking for The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri, which I thought I already owned. And so this is the penalty for chaotic bookshelves, is that occasionally you have to buy something that you know you already have, but you cannot find. And then I didn't come out with that in the end. I came out with a triple decker of Henry Green novels.
Oh, Living and Loving and Partying and things, that.
Yes. Yeah, I've always meant to read him, and I have never done so. He's been recommended a bunch of times, most recently by a TLS podcast listener, in fact, John Langridge, who described him or had heard him described as a writer, which sort of put me off, to be honest. But there you go. I went in for Jhumpa Lahiri and came out with Henry Green.
Yeah, it's pretty good, Henry Green. He's really interesting.
Well, this show will not be featuring Henry Green. We will perhaps save that for another podcast when I've actually read some. Instead, coming up on this week's show, a previously unpublished novel, The Man Who Lived Underground by Richard Wright, the African-American writer best known for Native Son, now sees the light of day about 80 years after it was written. Douglas Field will tell us about it, and dispatches from NB, including Sylvia Plath's fun little hobby, and the three greatest novels of the 21st century so far, continued. But first, we're going to talk about a new book by our esteemed contributor, Patricia J. Williams, published next week by TLS Books. Giving a Damn, Racism, Romance and Gone with the Wind is a deeply researched and deeply felt inquiry into the roots and legacy of racial injustice in the United States. The extended essay turns on the classic Civil War novel by Margaret Mitchell, published in 1936, which still exercises a powerful force on the American imagination. It comes second only to the Bible as the nation's favorite book. But the romance that still moves so many is, of course, rotten at its core. And to relish the myths of old Southern ways is to paper over cracks that threaten now to widen and swallow whole these apparently United States. In this week's TLS, we're running an extract from Giving a Damn, and Patricia Williams joins us on the line now to tell us more. Hello, Patricia.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks so much for coming on. I was trying to summarise your book to a friend over the weekend, and I said that it's about, among many, many things, the power of myth and how Gone with the Wind and the narrative structure and ethos it represents stalks American society. Does that seem to you a fair introduction?
Yes, indeed. It really is about the way in which parts of our population are enchanted, and that enchantment only goes so far if you are on the outside of the heroics of the internal narrative of such myth. And so the degree to which Gone with the Wind dresses up in flouncy frippery the image of Scarlett O'Hara and plantation life as dependent upon the invisible, ex-nominated labor of slaves. As the descendant of slaves, I feel somewhat excluded from that. And to say that hurts the feelings of those who really want to be Cinderella. It's an American version of Cinderella, of being recognized, of being beloved. And that is an ideal of womanhood that divides us right down the center, because it's so premised on a legacy that lives today.
And because in the book, I mean, you're sort of circling around a central paradox, aren't you? There's, you know, and there are other related paradoxes that come from this original one, but the paradox that the novel represents is sort of how this romance and the enjoyment of it coexists, or in fact exists precisely because of its opposite, the horror and exploitation and cruelty.
Yeah, I mean, I think the book opens with my overhearing a conversation that was about a gentleman seated next to me in a restaurant who was describing the great joy he felt in his son's wedding, I believe. And it was held on an old plantation. And plantations these days are much too frequently tourist destinations. And it was a wedding, apparently, which everybody got dressed up like Scarlett O'Hara in antebellum outfits. And one of the more disturbing parts of plantation tourism is that the waitstaff in the Deep South is still largely African American. And so the reiterated visual theater of this is not so different from what it was 150 years ago or so. And that is, that's part of the problem, that I heard this very, very differently. And I knew that if I had sort of put my head over the banquette and said, you know, excuse me, that sounds like, you know, it's wrong, you're dancing on graves, that he would have been resentful and heard me as politically correct. And I think the invisibility of my history as it clashes with his imagined history is part of the unfurling tension, but also the conversation we really need to have in the United States.
It's also, it seems particularly sort of outstanding that should be sort of repackaged and resold and celebrated. You know, you can pay to, I mean, not quite relive it, but as you say, to superficially relive it. That seems an extraordinary proposition.
And again, I think it makes sense if one gets lost in Gone with the Wind. There is certainly a great deal of racism in it. But the central carries the soul along narrative of that book is about fluttering hearts and dashing gentlemen and horses riding into the night. It is a rewriting, I think, and that's the deeper point of my book. It's a rewriting of Thomas Dixon's The Klansman, A Romance of the Ku Klux Klan. That was the title of Thomas Dixon's book, A Romance of the Ku Klux Klan. That is the book that was the basis for D.W. Griffith's film, Birth of a Nation. And in that book, it is much more explicitly tied to horrendous racism and the necessity to kill and beat back African Americans and recently emancipated slaves. And it is a pretty vivid description of the animus against political participation, the necessity to kill. That book and that movie gave rise to lynchings in the United States and really fueled the passage of Jim Crow laws. And so that's the ugly underside of a romantic tale, which then Margaret Mitchell made much more palatable, I think, and displaced the Southern lifestyle to the antebellum period before the unhappiness of the Civil War.
And I mean, part of what's obviously so interesting, both in terms of Dixon's book and Gone with the Wind and the film that was made, and of that, these things, these kind of cultural products, date from a time when it was presumed that that was American culture, the culture. It was a culture of mass produced by established organizations run by white men. And so these products come with an authoritative stamp of kind of collective cultural artifact, don't they? But we don't live in those times anymore.
Well, we shall see. I hope not. I mean, I'm sorry, it has been such a tumultuous year. Forgive me. I do feel like we're at something of a precarious moment. You know, just day before yesterday, there was the apparently accidental, supposedly release of an America First caucus that celebrates, in terms that are so close to Thomas Dixon's, it scared me, that celebrate the return to an ideal Anglo-Saxon version of America. And the language in that particular memo that apparently has Marjorie Taylor Greene's fingerprints all over it, but also seems to relate to a kind of Trumpian influence. That's worrisome, I think.
Well, I mean, certainly when I say we don't live in those times anymore, I certainly don't mean that it's over. I just mean in terms of the idea that there is one culture, one kind of powerhouse of production. And I suppose what we're seeing now is you write in your book about blackface, you know, Amos and Andy. And this now we're at a time where it's particularly interesting and fraught and certainly not exclusively American, this theme of how people are dealing with blackface, because there is awareness, certainly in some corners, that this is not okay, while other people feel that for it to not be okay is an attack on them and their culture and what, you know, used to be okay, so why isn't it now?
Yeah, I think this really is a time, delayed as it is, where we're working towards some kind of mutual awareness. And certainly in the times that Dixon wrote and even Margaret Mitchell some years later, there was a voicelessness that, you know, slaves were prevented from reading, not permitted to publish, not permitted to marry, couldn't make contracts. The traces of what they thought and felt are so rare and so few and far behind. You have Frederick Douglass's narrative. You have 12 Years a Slave. But these very occasional narratives are quite the exception. And the entire population of those who were enslaved, the legacy is in a few handcrafts and they're building and they're, and to some degree, the photographs of the machinery that was used to control them, the leg irons, the branding irons. And so the rest of this story is family history. And so that's also what my book is about. The degree to which this is an oral history, it lives in the living rooms of African Americans, just as I think the secret life of the Ku Klux Klan, of the gatherings for public lynchings, including children gathered to watch or to have picnics while people were lynched. We don't have tremendously official narratives about that, but it lives on in families that witnessed that brutality and that cruelty. And so I think that what is different now is that many people are starting to write about those legacies, as in Tulsa, Oklahoma, looking for the mass graves and the bodies that were buried as a result of such violence.
You diagnose in American attitudes towards identity and place a deep ambivalence. And this sort of nods back to what we were talking about before in terms of paradox, how something can be both. So, you know, ambivalence in that original sense of being both things at the same time. That you diagnose this ambivalence about the notion of home specifically. Can you expand on this for us, please?
Oh, yeah. I think the ability to be in one place over time has been such a longing within the African-American community or any diasporic community or forced diaspora. We are not a nomadic culture per se, but I think the need to escape is a very important part of the legacy of slavery. And it is so complicated, not just by the need to escape from plantations, the need to find the Pole Star. The Underground Railroad looked at, you know, to the North Star for the direction north to flee the southern states, the slave states, to escape to Canada. At the same time, leaving home was the tremendously fraught experience of being sold down the river. If the master or the owners of plantations died, or if their estate were in debt, they would sell their assets, which included furniture, horses, and slaves. And that meant families could be broken up, children sold away from their parents, husband and wife, or lovers, because frequently they weren't permitted to be married. But those who had settled in as mates could be parted and never see one another again. And because they were illiterate, it was very hard to reconnect, even after emancipation. And anti-slavery organizations did provide services whereby they would put ads in newspapers. Have you seen a woman of this description goes by the name such and such? And there are in the African American History Museum in Washington, D.C., the relatively new museum, one can read these very sad, have you seen, have you seen, have you seen, the little newspaper clippings that so remind one in today's world of, you know, after great disasters, after 9/11, after Katrina, you know, have you seen my loved one, I'm looking for. And of course, in those days, many of them didn't have any last names other than their latest owner.
And it's a sense that this kind of journey, this flight, this running away, this escape coexists again with a completely different narrative around what it means to take to the road and to go for freedom and adventure. And the fact that these two things coexist and sort of just can't be reconciled.
Yeah. In the United States, I mean, the immigrant myth, or the white immigrant myth, I should say, is one of mobility and cutting one's roots willingly because one comes from pogroms or famines or the Cossacks are coming. And so the ability to move about and to change one's name and to reinvent oneself is the companion to this myth. And that has not always been very accessible to African Americans.
That's another paradox, isn't it? Because that's the idea of the American dream. It reminds me, because we were talking about Nomadland and also to some extent Minari recently. And Nomadland had that double thing. It wasn't fueled by race, but it was fueled by poverty. So of course there is an intersection.
Yes,
there.
Yes. And I think that film or documentary, teledocumentary, whatever it is, really speaks to the degree to which there's always been this sense of identity and property that is profoundly American. And I think African Americans are at the center of the experience of being at the will of other people, and that will being the fact that you are in a property relationship with the people who feed you, that one becomes an extension of that property. But poor whites have also been in this box. I mean, one can read Grapes of Wrath and remember the Dust Bowl. And this is a condition that I think many white people in today's world, particularly since World War II and the GI Bill created a new American middle class, have forgotten or in some denial about, that if you just work, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But the degree to which some of these inequalities are the products of bad policy, bad structures, bad institutional decisions is something we need to collectively revisit.
You talk about America's crisis of identity, and this is something that goes well beyond the recent presidency of Donald Trump, who, no surprises, features quite prominently in your book. I wonder whether Trump's presidency added more anger to a sadness and a disappointment that was already there. The book has a note of lament running through it. You ask at one point, what has happened in the fluctuating tension of American narratives to allow Steve King's vision, its current political ascendancy, over Emma Lazarus's? Perhaps you can explain those references for us there and what you see is happening in this crisis of identity.
Yes, Steve King, a former congressman from the Midwest, was very noisy in his anti-immigration statements, with which Trump was in complete alliance. But Steve King said one cannot replace a civilization with, quote, other people's children. And that so-called replacement theory is a chant that went up during the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville a year and a half or 2 years ago. It is reiterated in a new Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's multiple statements. And it is in such contrast with Emma Lazarus's poem, which is engraved at the base of the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free." And under the Trump administration, that poem actually was the subject of a rewriting by a member of Trump's administration. It didn't get far, but nevertheless, it was a rewriting that said, give us people who can stand on their own two feet and bring money into the country, basically. And then clarified that what he meant was European immigrants.
So the exact opposite, in fact, of what it says under the Statue of Liberty.
Yes.
So, I mean, this book, it's clear, you know, it'd been simmering away for a while, hadn't it, before we first started talking about it, which would have been in, I think it was late 2019. So I'm wondering, you must have been already writing when George Floyd was murdered.
Yes.
How does that continue to feed into your thinking?
It is very much on my mind right now because I have been trying to write about the trial. It is one of the most moving and overwhelming experiences to have watched the prosecution of this trial. I am one of the few, perhaps, that simply couldn't watch the video of somebody dying. And when I watched the trial, I was caught off guard and I did watch the actual video, and not just that video, the one that has gone viral, but all of the other points of view of other cameras and angles that were taken that day. And I think the thing that perhaps a colleague of mine said, that one of the things that's most unsettling, I mean, is obviously his death, but it is also the way in which Derek Chauvin looks at the camera with such calm, implacable neutrality, that there's a way in which his gaze captures the eye of the spectator in a way that is almost an invitation to complicity. And that if you stay with his gaze, you feel involved in this death in a way that I think makes one want to shake it off, makes one have to step back. It makes you lose your breath. And I think that may be why this particular video was so powerful, because Lord knows in the United States, we've seen death after death, death after death. I think it is that profoundly, brutally, impersonal gaze that makes this one particularly distressing.
And that thing of being kind of forced to step back and look at the thing, that's sort of, and I don't say this at all lightly, but that's a source of fragile hope, I think, in your book, the sense that people can step back, be, you know, breathless about it, but can face up to all of the things that have been glossed over in the vision of America as, you know, land of the free. And that's the play in the title of your book, isn't it? I mean, because there's a defiance to the title of the book, which again takes us back to Gone with the Wind.
That is a very fragile hope that I have right now, because I have seen again, time and again, where some people are able to rationalize away, well, police are in a dangerous situation. Well, they feared for their lives. Well, it was a split second decision. That simply isn't the case here. You know, first of all, you have police witnesses and a number of them, including this man's immediate superiors, several of them, and the people who trained him. This was not split second. You live with the fullness of those 9 minutes and the submissive, the slowly dying body beneath him. And I hope that that's what finally allows people to feel what excessive means. And if they don't, I just worry that it gives license to the fact that it is always reasonable to be outlandishly afraid of the image of Black men, because this is not about the reality of George Floyd's resistance.
Well, Patricia Williams, we'll have to leave it there. This podcast is being recorded before the verdict arrives in that case. Hopefully by the time it airs, we'll have a sense of people do give a damn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on the show, Richard Wright's previously unpublished novel about a man, the human mole, who lives in the sewers, Sylvia Plath's domestic embellishments, and the three greatest novels of the 21st century so far, says who? And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer, exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So you'll have the paper turning up on your doorstep every week, where you'll find all the pieces we've talked about on this podcast, alongside dozens of other pieces, as well as getting access to everything online and in the app edition, should you find yourselves waiting for a bus without your print issue handy. The digital access also includes the website and app archives and the historical archive, which goes back to 1902. So you can look up Walter de la Mare and T.S. Eliot and read what Virginia Woolf made of D.H. Lawrence, Joseph Conrad and Aldous Huxley. There's original writing by Roland Barthes, Saul Bellow, John Updike, Muriel Spark, Chinua Achebe, Patricia Highsmith, Umberto Eco and Susan Sontag, and poems by Hardy, Auden Frost, Plath, Larkin, Brodsky, Paul Muldoon and Anne Carson. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Before we get to Richard Wright, Lucy, shall we turn to MB?
Yes, let's turn to MB. What have you noticed there?
Well, I wanted to draw everyone's attention to this chair of Sylvia Plath's. So it's up for auction. And it's interesting because it has been, well, they attempted to auction it in 2018 and it didn't sell. So the chair itself, so it's a nursery chair that Sylvia Plath bought and later decorated for her daughter, Frieda Hughes. And so you can see these beautiful little hearts and flowers and twiddly bits, for want of a better word.
It looks a bit Scandinavian, like Scandinavian folk art. It looks a little bit like that to me. It's really pretty. It's lovely.
Yeah, I sort of thought like Tyrolese Alpine vibes.
Yes, yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so she loved Sylvia Plath, adored. She said, I just love painting woodwork and pretending I'm making my own house. And Ted Hughes, in fact, in the birthday letters, wrote, you painted little hearts on everything. So this was a thing. And so she decorated this chair for her daughter, and it was well used and well loved. And then Ted Hughes gave it to a friend for her children, and then it was returned to Frieda some years back, along with three balls of wool that had been used to weave the original, now I think completely destroyed, seat. So it was up for auction in 2018 at Bonhams and failed to sell, which I find astounding. But presumably collectors were distracted by other items such as Plath's typewriter, her copy of The Bell Jar and her much underlined Roger's Thesaurus, which she said, I would rather live with on a desert island than a Bible. I mean, who wouldn't? But so that chair now, along with the wool, is being offered for sale once more, this time at Woolley and Wallace, which is fitting given the seat. And it carries an estimate of between £200 and £400, which seems not very much to me for something like that. I think when it was on at Bonhams, it was given an estimate of 3,000 to 5,000.
Maybe it will be one of those things that will, you know, go way above the
snowball,
the asking price. It's a beautiful thing.
Maybe. It sort of makes you think as well about, with this sort of a purchase, would you want to see it kept, you know, with, as MC puts it in MB, curatorial respect, just as it is? Or would you dare to use it? Because in a sense, that's also preserving it, isn't it? If it was well used and loved in its first life, and if that was what was intended, in a way, it's about preserving the spirit of it rather than merely the image. Do you see what I mean?
I do, yeah. I think it depends on the intention behind buying it. Mm. Are you buying it as a sort of literary
objet,
exactly, or are you buying it as a sort of family thing? Except if it's not your family, but it might be a family that you're interested in. Mm. You might be able to buy Sylvia Plath's chair for £200. I saw something else that I meant to, which this is not in MB, but if you've got nearly £3 million, you could buy Agatha Christie's house, I noticed. Mm. So somewhere in between, if you're either feeling a bit skint or really quite well off, there's a range of things. Her house in Wallingford, which looks really nice.
Yes, or perhaps if you're feeling particularly flush, you could buy Sylvia Plath's child's chair to put in.
Put it in Agatha Christie's house.
It's like the woman who ate the fly, who ate the etc.
It would be expensive, but it would be good.
It really would. If a famous person, a famous writer has lived in a house, does it raise the house price?
Well, apparently the people who, when they bought it 20 years ago or something. It's family living there, or maybe more than 20 years ago. And they didn't know that.
Oh.
There wasn't a plaque. There wasn't anything. They bought it because it's a lovely house. And then they, and then that, that, you know, now there is a plaque on it. So presumably maybe it will. And I think it's maybe it's also the house. It's supposed to be the house that Miss Marple lived in is slightly based on that house. Ah. I think there are similarities. So if you're feeling sleuthy and you've got a spare £3 million, you know what to do with it.
There's also an update, isn't there, on our new parlour game, the three greatest novels of the 21st century to date.
It's a bit of a rarefied parlour game, this one. Yeah, so there was originally, we talked about it a few weeks ago, originally suggestions were All for Nothing by Walter Kempowski, The Lesser Bohemians by Emma McBride, and The Line of Beauty by Alan Hollinghurst. And then someone else has obviously suggested some more. It says Arrival Authority on the subject. Clearly there's a lot of very eminent people writing in. Agreeing about The Lesser Bohemians, which they prefer to A Girl is a Half-Form Thing. Also adding Duck's Newburyport by Lucy Ellman and Dodge Rose by Jack Cox. And Dodge Rose is apparently a bit like Henry Green. Now, we didn't mean to do that, did we? But we have actually tied him up. Henry Green, Joyce and William Gaddis. So that's clearly, that person likes novels that, shall we say, push the boat out a bit. Experimental, formally interesting novels, it sounds like. And then someone else wrote in, someone with a name that might be familiar to you, Emma Knightley. We suspect it's not their real name. Who suggested Baudolino by Umberto Eco, The Last Days of New Paris by China Mieville, which I do know, both very, very interesting, and The Rites of Ecstasy by Hélène Lavelle.
I must say that I thought that maybe Emma Knightley, if that is her real name, it isn't her real name, was you briefly.
It was me.
Just until I read on, because it was postmodern game playing, perfect Lucy Dallas territory, China Mieville, and then something French that I hadn't heard of. So I thought, oh well, this must be Lucy Dallas.
Absolutely is not.
But then I read on and it isn't.
Because apparently the third book, The Rites of Ecstasy, is it's not very clear whether it was in French or maybe it's been translated into French. Anyway. It's a provocative novel, shall we say. It sounds a bit racy. The MC gives us just the first line. Gabrielle has always been prone to vivid dreams, and then he says, "I think we'd better stop there."
So, there are raptures and tortures involved.
I think
involved.
It's a slightly different sort of novel. Put it that way, experimental, but maybe not in that way.
Well, it sounds. Perhaps this isn't unfair. Perhaps it is. I don't know. But it sounds a dubious contender to best novels of greatest novels of the 21st century so far. But I haven't read it, so I will say no more. But Lucy, you're going to tell us about a different book that was published in the 21st century, but not written in it.
Yes, exactly. We're going to talk about a book that is being published in the 21st century, but is arriving about 80 years late. So let's wind back. In August 1941, if you happen to be reading that month's issue of True Detective magazine, you might have seen a story about the crime Hollywood couldn't believe, which was in fact a series of crimes that had been committed a decade earlier. Thefts of money, food, and even typewriters from a number of properties with no obvious means of entrance or exit. And the culprit, it turned out, was a former sewer worker who had taken to living in the sewers and realised he could get into places more or less at will. Also reading that magazine was Richard Wright, whose first novel, Native Son, had been a huge success the year before. And Douglas Field has written about the connections between these events, and we're delighted that he's here to talk about it with us today. Douglas, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me. Very nice to be here.
So what happened after Richard Wright read the story about the crime Hollywood couldn't believe?
Well, Wright had a burgeoning interest in crime fiction, and he read this story with a sensational headline, the crime Hollywood couldn't believe. And he was really struck by the plot. It was based on true events where a white sewage worker, or former sewage worker who'd been unemployed started tunneling his way into properties, and he stole a number of things, linen, typewriters, bits of food, and he wasn't caught for ages. And Wright found this really fascinating and drew parallels between the culprit, who was called Herbert Wright, no relation, and the ways in which African Americans were pushed out of sight in American society. And so there was a kind of wonderful twist where he reimagined Herbert Wright as an African American in his short novel, which became The Man Who Lived Underground.
So it's because it's a very fertile metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And W.B. Du Bois, one of the leading activists and writers of the 20th century, an African-American prolific writer, had made the case that African-Americans were living behind the veil. So there's already this metaphor that Wright would have been clearly aware of.
So he gave it into his publisher. And why do you think the publisher turned it down? Because Native Son, which I had referred to as first novel, which he published in 1940, I think, which you call his incendiary first novel, it had been a tremendous success, hadn't it?
It was a huge success. It was picked up by the Book of the Month Club and sold around 250, maybe even a quarter of a million copies in 3 weeks. Wright had to edit it down some of the more violent episodes of the novel, but it was a huge bestseller, bought mainly by white readers. But then it's that difficult second novel. He'd written a collection of novellas or kind of extended short stories in 1938, Uncle Tom's Children. But I think his publishers were unsure. It was a slender piece. Native Son is a very long novel. This is around 60 to 70,000 words. And also, I think the message about police brutality was, I mean, it's very, very current now, but I think it was too shocking for his editor and perhaps the agent too.
He obviously didn't agree. He was very attached to the story, wasn't he? It seems that he couldn't let it go and he kept on trying to place it.
Yes, there's something rather poignant about it. I mean, it's only now that Library of America have published it, but he tried on many, many occasions. Some people who know the posthumous collection of short stories, Eight Men, will know a short version of The Man Who Lived Underground, and that came out in 1961. But he tried, he published a few pages in 1942 in a little magazine called The Scent, and then a slightly better known selection of writing, Edwin Seaver's book, which is called Cross Section, A Collection of New American Writing. But he kept trying to get it published. And it's a real shame that it was only just being published. And I think now, with the descriptions of police brutality, the novel is, without giving too much away, is centered on an African-American who's picked up by police and tortured, and then confesses under duress for a crime he didn't commit, is extremely poignant in today's racial politics.
Yes, and it's as you say, it's all too relevant, unfortunately. Do you think, as a novel, I mean, there is the obvious social import of the message, and do you think also as a novel it succeeds?
I think it does in places. I think, I wanted to like it slightly more than I did, and it's definitely worth reading. And there are some beautiful lyrical passages. And one of the points I try to make in the review is that Wright is capable of writing lyrically and very softly. But there's a sense that, in 1941, that Wright couldn't afford to be nuanced and couldn't afford to not to slightly hammer home the message, I can absolutely see why. In an essay that he wrote in 1937, he makes the case that African-American literature hadn't really been studied by white critics. And so there wasn't really the space or the time for him to tread softly. So I think there are parts of the novel where it suffers from Wright hectoring rather than implying, but it's well paced. There's some really good scenes of kind of noir fiction and great dialogue, and there's some beautiful lyrical, slightly surreal descriptions of the narrator's experience underground. So it's absolutely worth reading, and it's quite a gripping novel, but it's slightly falls short, I think, in terms of writing, say, by James Baldwin, with whom he's often compared.
I was going to talk about that, actually, because you say in your piece that recent critical opinion has been less kind to Wright and to Baldwin, whose work has enjoyed a startling renaissance, or to Ellison, whose reputation as a nuanced, jazz-inflected stylist is unsurpassed. Is fair to say that, I mean, they're often compared, aren't they, those three writers, but also they all knew each other. He had a fractious relationship with both of them, didn't he?
He did. So Baldwin was 14 years younger, and Wright was something of a mentor to him. He helped him get a fellowship when he was working on his first novel, which became Go Tell It on the Mountain. And, you know, Wright was quite an avuncular, slightly aloof figure, but he was very helpful. Wright went to Paris and ended up settling there in 1947, and Baldwin went the following year. And Baldwin's first major essay was Everybody's Protest Novel, in which he lambasted Wright for his use of protest fiction. And so it became a slightly sort of almost a kind of Oedipal moment where Wright felt absolutely betrayed by Baldwin. Ellison was the best man at Wright's first wedding. I think it was his first wedding. He's married at least twice. And they were very, very close. But then, well, Wright died in 1960. Ellison, quite a bit later, and Baldwin in 1987. Ellison began to kind of distance himself from Wright for some of the reasons that I've outlined. There was a sense that Wright kept hammering home the same messages, and Ellison wanted to distance himself and adapt more. And I think there's something rather poignant about that. I kind of think of Wright as a rather a lone figure who's absolutely kind of has a brilliant sort of work ethic. He's got integrity, but he lacks that ability to adapt. And he dies, of course, as the civil rights movement is gathering momentum. And Baldwin, Ellison kind of detached himself from civil rights movement. He sort of believed that politics would dilute a writer's craft. But Baldwin, as we know, was very much at the forefront of much of the civil rights movement.
It's interesting that story as a background, how you sort of read Richard Wright's career and the success, or, well, the failure of this novel that is only now seeing the light of day, how you read it against the backdrop of the story of criticism and changes in what was looked for and valued in literature and Wright's inability to, well, not even necessarily inability to, probably it was a mixture of inability to and also perhaps not being allowed to break out of the mold that he had been, that he had first arrived in with Native Son, in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, it's a choice. You know, I think Wright made the decision that he needed to forgo subtlety and nuance. And I make the point, I mean, it might be slightly overstated in my review, but, you know, John Crow Ransom is writing influential work from the late 1930s, where the new criticism becomes a way of teasing out ambiguity and nuance. And I kind of feel that, I mean, it struck me that whilst Wright is crafting The Man Who Lived Underground, he's sort of out of step with that development. And in some ways, fair enough, you know, I kind of respect him for that. But in terms of some of the literature that's emerging, it already feels slightly dated. And there's a sense, I think, that, you know, it becomes apparent why he doesn't quite abandon writing fiction, but he struggles to get his fiction published. He has this amazing success with the first novel, not his first book, but his first novel, and then really struggles to regain form. And in some ways, I think that's because he's so devoted to the kind of politics of what he's doing, and he becomes increasingly invested in looking at developing countries and the effects of industrialization, that he sees fiction as something of a luxury. His later work is very much committed to looking at kind of the effects of global racism.
And even in terms of the forms that he chooses, then he's sort of concentrating. If you talk about fiction as a luxury, by the end he's writing haikus, which are just so economical.
Yes, yeah, I think that's fascinating. I mean, he wrote a lot of poetry in the 1930s when he was a member of the Communist Party, and he was very much committed to that cause. And I find it fascinating that, yes, that returns to haiku and the economy of it, which also, I mean, some of them are absolutely wonderful. And you know, he's got a real ear for the economy of haiku. And bits of that, I think, come across in The Man Who Lived Underground, the economy. But there's too many passages for me that felt as though he could be more nuanced, could be more delicate, but he chose not to. But as I say, I think there's something to be commended as well.
He wrote hundreds and hundreds of them, didn't he? And it was kind of, seemed to be after he was recovering from an illness. And some of them are like little vignettes, and some of them do seem to are looking at politics and race and injustice. And some of them are more like traditional in the sense that they're, you know, noticing nature or, you know, coming to terms with the passing of the seasons or passing of time.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating insight into Wright. And I think there's as a try, and I hope you know, say fairly in the review, that there's a sense that Wright is seen as slightly one-dimensional, almost slightly tone deaf. But I think reading the haiku shows a very different side. It's interesting that I think as well that Leroy Jones, who then became Amiri Baraka, revised the haiku form into what he called the loku, C-O-U-P, and which are really, really kind of politically bristling with anger, often very funny as well. And I wonder, I don't know if it's the case, but I wonder if Baraka was influenced by Wright. I kind of rather hope he was.
I was thinking what you were saying about the critics. I mean, in a way, he couldn't win, could he? Because, as you say, on the one hand, he's criticised for writing protest fiction that's not nuanced enough, that's, you know, very straightforward and very hard-hitting. But then after he went to live in France, some people thought he was friends with Sartre and Camus and stuff, apparently. And there were people saying, oh, no, he's much too much influenced by those guys. And so he sort of couldn't win.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a long tradition of American writers settling in Paris, you know, sort of Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, but also quite a few African-Americans, you know, Baldwin, the cartoonist Ollie Harrington. Mm.
Quite a few musicians as well were over there too, yeah.
A lot of musicians as well, absolutely. And there's a sense that, you know, he became, you know, criticism was that he was too distant from the civil rights movement as that was gathering momentum, that he, and this is a criticism which is also leveled at Baldwin as well, but Baldwin came back and in the 1950s and was very much kind of on the front line, and he was, you know, Baldwin was, gave scores of interviews and was very, very, very visible, whereas Wright seemed a little bit alone and sort of detached. At least that was the sense, perhaps unfairly.
And there's also, you talk about an essay that's published alongside the novel, Memories of My Grandmother, and you find a different tone there as well, don't you, from his longer work?
Yeah, it's a superb essay. He wrote it originally with the intention of publishing it alongside the short novel, The Man Who Lived Underground. And it's really long. It's about, I think it's about 16,000 words long. And I think The Man Who Lived Underground is only about 60, maybe 65,000 words. And there's some beautiful recollections of his grandmother who appears in his memoir, Black Boy, which was published to great acclaim in 1945. And there's some beautiful descriptions of her. As a woman, as his grandparents had been born slaves. Wright himself had grown up in Mississippi. His father was a sharecropper. And yeah, there's some beautiful, there's a kind of shift in tone, absolutely, where there's a kind of lyrical quality to the writing, which, as I mentioned, he couldn't quite sustain in his fiction. But it's the lecture and essay is a genre that suited him, I think. It kind of opens him up in ways that his fiction didn't always do.
You mentioned another unpublished novel. You just mentioned it in passing, which he was struggling to complete at the same time as he was writing The Man Who Lived Underground, Black Hope, another long novel, I think, about black domestic workers. And that remains unpublished. Do you think that we might, perhaps off the back of this Library of America publication, that one might see its day in print as well? Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it. I've read about it. And yeah, I think it will. I mean, Wright, in Eight Men, Wright, there's a fascinating story where Wright tells the story of a man who can't get work. So he dresses up as a woman because there was more work available for domestic workers. And it's a kind of fascinating theme. And I don't know if the short story bears any relation to the unpublished novel, but it's an area that, you know, that Wright, I think, shows his commitment to the labour market and to the kind of really difficult economic circumstances facing domestic workers. I don't know whether, I mean, I would be surprised if it wasn't published by the Library of America. My sense is that this novel will do quite well. And I'd be interested to see the other reviews. I wonder if I've been a little bit too harsh on Wright. But yeah, I think it will come out.
Well, we've got that to look forward to, as well as The Man Who Lived Underground. Thank you very much for talking to us about it, Douglas.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
That is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Patricia J. Williams and Douglas Field. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.